Today is Friday, August 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, just months before the presidential election, many Americans wonder if their votes will be counted following efforts by the president to cast doubt on the postal system.
If they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it.
COVID-19 survivors say the virus leaves a lasting impact on their health long after they were first infected.
Neurological issues, COVID onset diabetes, hair loss, chronic fatigue, shortness of breath, you name it, there doesn't seem to be a body system that is not affected.
Also ahead, in what is sure to shift Mideast politics, Israel reaches an agreement to normalize relations with a major Arab nation. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump says he's against more funding for the Postal Service, acknowledging funding would starve the agency of money Democrats say it needs to process a surge in mail-in ballots. His comments first came Tuesday on Fox Business Network.
They need that money in order to have the post office work so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots. Now, in the meantime, they aren't getting there. By the way, those are just two items. But if they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it.
Democrats are pushing for a coronavirus relief package to contain billions of dollars to boost election security and help postal workers in what's expected to be a flood of mail-in ballots during the coronavirus pandemic. Democrats say the president is admitting he wants to hold up the Postal Service to hinder Americans from voting, while the Biden campaign is accusing Trump of sabotage. Joining us for analysis is UC Hastings Constitutional Law Professor Joel Paul. Thank you so much for being with us. So what, if any, are the potential legal pitfalls of the president's statement?
There are both federal and state laws that prohibit people from taking actions that would prevent mail delivery. So if you are a postal worker or if you're a private citizen who interferes in the delivery of the mails, that constitutes tampering with the mail, and it is a federal crime and can also be a state crime, depending on state law. There's also laws that prohibit any person from intimidating a voter in the exercise of the right to vote in a federal election. So to the extent that the president, by discouraging voters from voting by mail, is compelling voters to go to the polls at a time during the pandemic when particularly older voters may feel that it is threatening to their life and health, that constitutes voter intimidation and may also violate federal and state laws.
Aren't there constitutional issues related to the Postal Service that it is, in fact, a service provided to Americans that is in the Constitution?
Yes. Well, the Constitution does give Congress the authority to create a Postal Service. And the whole function of the Post Office was to provide a service at a low cost to every American. And by turning the Postal Service into a sort of profit making enterprise, we are, in a sense, denying Americans that opportunity to have a level playing field in their access to communicate with other people. There's another constitutional question here, which I think is even more important. The Constitution explicitly gives Congress and the state legislatures the exclusive power to decide when the election will be held and under what circumstances. They alone can prescribe the manner of elections. The states have chosen to create mail-in voting. They have authorized mail-in voting. The president now is trying to interfere in the exercise of that constitutional power by the states, and that raises profound constitutional issues.
So if the president continues to refuse to authorize the funds, what recourse does Congress have?
Congress doesn't really have much recourse in terms of getting the funding to the post office if the president refuses to sign the legislation. But the states do have recourse in terms of changing their laws in order to make it clear that efforts by the president or anyone to delay the delivery of the ballots is illegal under state law. It's also possible that the postal workers themselves can simply agree to continue working and to ensure that every ballot is delivered, regardless of whether they get paid overtime. And the third possibility is that individual voters, simply by getting their ballots in the mail as early as possible, can ensure that their ballots will be counted.
So even though it's, as you said, it's against the law to try to in any way disrupt voting or interfere in the process of voting, there's not a lot of legal recourse, even though there are potential criminality?
There is legal recourse in the sense that one could go to a court and get what's called a writ of mandamus, order from the court to the Postmaster General to ensure that the ballots are delivered promptly, to make sure that they're given priority. That's a possibility. It's also possible that if the president were threatened by prosecutors at the state level, that they would indict the president and also potentially the Postmaster General for failing to deliver the ballots. That too might be an effective way of discouraging this kind of activity.
If the president has the right to refuse to sign Congress's bill appropriating funding to help the post office in the midst of a pandemic when it's expecting a flood of more mail-in ballots and it doesn't have the resources and can't do it without the funding, how would Congress have any recourse if the president has a right not to sign it and yet it's not legal for him to interfere?
The issue now is whether or not Congress can pass a $25 billion emergency appropriation as part of the coronavirus legislation to provide additional funds to the post office for overtime pay for postal workers. The president's refusing to sign that legislation. He's saying, I'm not going to approve $25 billion. If the legislation were to pass, the president can't deny the funding. He can't impound the funds. That's unconstitutional. But he can prevent the passage of the legislation. However, the president today declared his criminal intention to try to discourage people from exercising their right to vote as provided under state law. That's what's criminal. That's what potentially is actionable in state courts or in federal courts. And so action could be taken by a state or federal prosecutor or by just an individual seeking to get an order to command the Postmaster General to deliver the ballots in a timely fashion.
UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul, thank you for being with us. President Donald Trump Thursday criticized his Democratic presidential contender, Joe Biden, who on Thursday called for all U.S. governors to mandate mask wearing to slow the spread of the coronavirus.
Today we saw Joe Biden continue to politicize a pandemic and to show his appalling lack of respect for the American people. That's what it is.
On his second day on the campaign trail with running mate Kamala Harris by his side, Biden said wearing a mask is not political, it's patriotic.
I say, look, this is America. Be a patriot. Protect your fellow citizens. Protect your fellow citizens. Step up. Do the right thing.
He made the call for a nationwide mandate on masks after a virtual meeting with public health advisors in his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. The virus has killed more than 165,000 people in the United States. In the late winter and early spring, when the novel coronavirus epidemic first began to emerge globally, scientists and epidemiologists knew very little about the disease. That's why in late March, COVID-19 survivor Diana Barrent founded a grassroots movement called Survivor Corps. Its mission was to mobilize survivors to donate their antibody-rich plasma and to encourage them to volunteer in scientific research studies working to understand the virus and develop treatments. Survivor Corps has also developed an online forum for survivors. And now, 5 months and millions of infections later, doctors are discovering that even survivors who are no longer infectious are coping with debilitating long-term symptoms. VOA's Adam Phillips, who spoke to Barrent in March, caught up with her for an update on what she's learned.
We have learned so much since last we spoke. When we spoke last, we thought it was a respiratory disease. We now understand it's a clotting disease, which is why it's affecting the brain and the heart and the kidneys and all of the other organs. And we thought that it only affected the elderly and the immunocompromised, but we are all extremely vulnerable to this disease. There's nobody who is safe from it. And we now know it's airborne. That changes things dramatically.
What else have you learned?
That COVID is having a long-term impact on people's bodies and on children's bodies as well. But the real issue is that as a global community, we are tracking infections, tracking hospitalizations, and tracking morbidity. However, the vast majority of people who are infected with COVID, and we are now at over 5 million infections in the United States, are being actively told to not seek any medical help whatsoever unless they cannot breathe, in which case they are to go to the emergency room. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community. Their experiences have gone basically unrecorded, and they are suffering 5-6 months into the virus with debilitating symptoms.
You quoted a CDC report from a couple of weeks ago, says that 1 in 3 people who've been infected with the coronavirus still have long-term symptoms of the disease, even after 14 days.
Absolutely. And the people they are referring to are not the people who are hospitalized. We're talking about the people who recovered at home, like me, never saw their doctor. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community.
Since March 24th, when you started, you've amassed a huge repository of anecdotal reports from coronavirus survivors.
We have over 90,000 members recording their experiences in real time, and we're able to take that information and translate that data into information that can inform clinicians on what to look for in helping these people who are having long-term symptoms and helping those patients whose doctors are diagnosing them with anxiety, as opposed to recognizing that they are having very serious medical complications, neurological issues, tachycardia, COVID onset diabetes, hair loss, chronic fatigue, shortness of breath, you name it. There doesn't seem to be a body system that is not affected by this virus. And the doctors are flummoxed and trying to compare it with other post-viral reactions. But these are not mild symptoms. These are quite intense. The scary thing is the people who are suffering the most are the ones who are in their 20s and 30s, who had no underlying conditions, were never hospitalized, and now 5 months in post-COVID, they cannot climb a flight of stairs.
It's a delicate thing, getting doctors who rely only on data-driven studies to take even a mountain of anecdotal reports very seriously.
You're absolutely right. And that is really informed our mission, creating an educational feedback loop between patients and the medical and scientific community. And we are also actually launching Recovery Corps, which will be a longitudinal study done in coordination with Columbia University. It will track COVID patients over years, tracking their antibody levels and tracking them symptomatically to see how their symptoms evolve and hopefully resolve over time. But unfortunately, we are going to need to have post-COVID care centers throughout the country.
COVID-19 survivor Diana Barrett, who founded a grassroots movement called Survivor Corps, speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. President Donald Trump has scored a rare diplomatic win in what he calls a truly historic moment in the Middle East. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara reports.
Emirati Muslims can now pray in the historic Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem after the United Arab Emirates announced Thursday it has normalized relations with Israel. At the White House, President Donald Trump applauded the announcement.
Now that the ice has been broken, I expect more Arab and Muslim countries will follow the United Arab Emirates' lead.
The UAE-Israel agreement is only the third Israel-Arab peace deal since Israel's declaration of independence in 1948. Egypt signed one in 1979 and Jordan in 1994. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a historic day, a sentiment supported by administration officials.
It wouldn't surprise me if the president's eventually nominated for a Nobel Prize.
In terms of a step towards regional peace, I think that that part is currently being exaggerated. There was never a threat of a conflict between Israel and the UAE. But this is the first Gulf state to normalize relations with Israel, and that's going to open up a lot of new possibilities for the two countries.
As part of the deal, Israel has agreed to suspend further annexation of Palestinian land in the West Bank. Analysts say that taking annexation off the table benefits Israel strategically, since it won't absorb a significant number of Palestinians against their will.
Thus putting over the long term Israel in a really terrible position of choosing what they're going to pick their Jewish identity or their identity as a liberal democratic state. That's not a situation that any friend of Israel wants to see Israel in over the long run.
The UAE-Israel deal is seen as further isolating another regional power, Iran. The U.S. is currently trying to push a U.N. Security Council resolution to extend an arms embargo on Tehran due to expire in October. China and Russia have signaled they will veto it. If the resolution fails, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has threatened to invoke the snapback option, restoring all U.N. sanctions on Iran.
We're not going to talk to you about that. We're going to work something out and then we'll talk after it's completed. But it'll be very satisfactory.
Trump said the UAE and Israel will join the U.S. to formally sign the agreement in Washington in the next few weeks. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Lebanon's port of Beirut, severely damaged in the recent devastating explosion, has resumed partial operations, according to authorities. Kuwait has offered to help Lebanon reconstruct and operate the facility, as well as others in the cash-strapped nation. Analysts say China is also eyeing its prospects to rebuild the port as yet another entryway to spread its influence in the eastern Mediterranean. As Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, overtures to Beijing are raising concern.
Journalist Baria Alamuddin, writing in Saudi newspaper Arab News, has expressed alarm that Iran-backed Hezbollah courted China. She says Chinese companies have long sought to play a major role in Lebanese infrastructure projects, proposing $12 billion worth of investments in ports, railways, electricity, and waste management. But as Alamuddin points out, infrastructure projects reliant on Chinese engineers and labor would hardly reduce Lebanon's 35% unemployment rate. China's Xinhua news agency reports a Chinese engineering company has been working to rehabilitate one of Lebanon's other ports, Tripoli, creating a berth to accommodate Chinese cranes capable of moving about 700 containers per day. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that the majority of Lebanese don't want to leave the West or Arab spheres of influence for those of Hezbollah and China.
If this continues, a Chinese port or two, both Tripoli and Beirut, will be coming to a coastline near you in the Mediterranean. The way the Chinese do these things is they set up debt traps for countries. This gets them to fall completely into China's lap. Is this what the U.S. and the West want for Lebanon, the Levant, and for the Eastern Mediterranean?
Since 2013, China has embarked on an ambitious, expansive infrastructure project known as the Belt and Road Initiative, which involves investing in several nations. Some critics say it leaves host countries with massive amounts of debt. China says no political strings are attached to its investments and loans. The Middle East Institute's president, Paul Salem, says there are major concerns about China potentially rebuilding Beirut's port. He says it would present a huge geographical long-term issue since a country just doesn't build ports for a year or two.
Obviously, China is the main builder of ports, is ready to do so and extend its influence in the Mediterranean. It already has a presence to manage Haifa port in Israel, which has been a huge concern for the United States. It also has a deal with Athens over Piraeus port. If it were to rebuild Beirut port in the next 5 to 10 years, that would mean for the 21st century, China dominates in terms of trade and so on, the Eastern Mediterranean.
Salem says, however, he does not think that Beirut port will be rebuilt in a major way. Hezbollah, he says, doesn't want to relinquish the port and so may possibly have it patched up. He says it is unlikely that neither China nor any other country would want to invest $5 billion in the port if Hezbollah would continue to keep it at risk. But Salem says he hopes the international community will continue to press Lebanese politicians for badly needed political reform. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
For the first time in its 70-year history, UNICEF USA has launched a program to help kids in the United States as the nation reels from the coronavirus pandemic, economic shock, and issues of racial injustice. Joining us to talk about it is Michael Nienhuis, president and CEO of UNICEF USA. Thank you for being with us. We have all, of course, heard about the work the organization does globally for children. Tell us about this new program.
We are launching an initiative called Child Friendly Cities, and it's intended to help communities across our country address the holistic needs of children, especially vulnerable children in their communities, to be able to live healthier, more productive lives.
Was this launched because of the current situation in our country with the coronavirus and the economic impacts of that, or was this something that was already in the works?
I think it's a connection of three different things. One is that there are vulnerable children in our country, and while UNICEF traditionally serves in the poorest places in the world with the most vulnerable children in areas of crisis and disaster, vulnerable kids right here in our own country. And the reality is those children often fare worse than kids in other developed countries around the world. And so there is real need here. That's one. Number two, the Child Friendly Cities Initiative that we're piloting here is a global UNICEF strategy and priority already. There are 3,500 cities and municipalities across the world in about 40 countries that have adopted this framework to improve the lives of children in their communities already. So we're bringing a tried and true methodology here. And then I would say third, it is sort of a confluence of work that we've begun, but is being accelerated because of the recognition of needs that have been really made clear to us through the COVID crisis, but also the current climate of concern, again, of racial injustice and the reality of some of the marginalized communities in our country. So I think if you bring those three things together, this feels like the right moment to really accelerate the strategy.
What are the biggest needs here in the U.S. for children that you'll be focused on, and what kinds of things will you be doing to try to make a difference for them?
The Child Friendly Cities Initiative sort of has five major pillars or goal areas. They're safety and inclusion of children, children's participation, their voice to be heard, equitable social services available to all children, safe living environments, and also play and leisure. So we're working with local governments and the civil society players within those communities to really take a hard look at how all five of those areas are being addressed and to make improvements and expansions in that kind of work.
As far as you're seeing right now that kids are struggling with in the U.S., is it hunger? Is it safety? All of those things that you just talked about as far as you're addressing.
I would say the needs of children in the types of cities that we're working with in here are, you know, across the board. Those needs are for decent housing and for social programs that give them ways to play and to have leisure, the equitable distribution of parks, safety and issues with police, justice issues. All those sorts of things are affecting children in these communities. And we think they need to be addressed holistically rather than picking out just one or two areas.
This has launched officially?
Yes, we have two cities that have already signed agreements with us, San Francisco and Houston. We have a handful of others that are along the way, Minneapolis, Prince George's County and Maryland, Johnson City, Tennessee, and several others that are coming right behind it that are really interested in adopting this framework.
Michael Nienhuis, President and CEO of UNICEF USA, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Scientists fear a lasting impact on coral reefs that have lived for centuries at the fringes of Mauritius following what they call massive poisonous shock, following days of smothering heavy fuel oil that spilled from a wrecked Japanese tanker nearby. The full impact of the toxic spill is still unfolding as the Indian Ocean Islands residents scramble to mop up the oil slicks and clumps they're seeing, floating dead fish in the water and fuel-soaked seabirds limping onto shore. An ally of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko is issuing a rare public apology in a bid to quell nationwide street protests that pose the biggest challenge to the strong man leader's 26-year rule. At least two protesters have died and thousands have been detained this week in a crackdown following Lukashenko's contested re-election that has prompted the West to consider new sanctions. And Tropical Storm Josephine formed in the Atlantic Ocean Thursday, becoming the earliest 10th named storm on record, which forecasters say is another sign the Atlantic hurricane season is more active than usual. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A research mission that launched into space more than a decade ago continues bearing ample fruit for scientists on Earth. What began as an operation to learn the origins of our solar system is yielding additional exciting discoveries. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the week in space.
4, 3, 2, main engine start. 1, 0, and liftoff of the...
NASA's Dawn spacecraft mission, launched in 2007, continues to make discoveries. The latest, announced by NASA this week, a saltwater reservoir about 40 kilometers beneath the surface of Ceres, a dwarf planet some 4.5 billion years old that survived the earliest days of our solar system. The aim of the 2007 mission was to study an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. In 2015, after examining a giant asteroid named Vesta, Dawn visited Ceres. It ran out of its primary fuel in October 2018, and NASA placed it in orbit to keep it from crashing into anything. NASA currently has no plans to revisit Ceres, but Dawn remains the only spacecraft to orbit the two extraterrestrial destinations.
Ignition.
In other news, fresh off a successful round-trip visit to the International Space Station, SpaceX launched a Falcon 9 rocket from Cape Canaveral carrying 57 Starlink satellites.
You can see the video just came back here of them floating away into space.
The satellites join hundreds of others already in orbit. SpaceX plans to build a 12,000-satellite mega-constellation to beam broadband internet from space to Earth. Finally, these images taken from orbit above Earth show what is believed to be the Yongbyon Nuclear Scientific Research Center near the Kuryong River in North Korea. The pictures suggest recent flooding may have damaged pump houses connected to the country's main nuclear facility. Experts say the images show the area's vulnerability to extreme weather events. Yongbyon is about 100 kilometers north of Pyongyang and home to the facilities thought to be used in the country's nuclear weapons program. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, Lady Gaga has been confirmed as the latest artist to perform at the 2020 MTV Video Music Awards. She'll join a group of previously confirmed performers for the VMAs, which air live on Sunday, August 30th. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks for being with us and have a great weekend.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000.